The neighbor, standing in his front yard, took two shotgun blasts to the face in a mafia dispute. At 5, murder visited again with the bombing of the rival family's house just a few doors down. Blood, police lights, walking past rubble became fixtures of kindergarten, just like snacks and nap time. Now a familiar house guest, murder came again when I was 7. A man burglarizing my grandparents' Austin home killed my grandfather and beat my grandmother near to death. My parents and sister were lost in worry and grief and anger in the years following this most recent visit by murder. Fair and obvious reactions to most observers. At 7, though this was not obvious to me, I was careless of my vulnerability. And so it was during this time that an older child in the neighborhood targeted and adeptly groomed me for a couple of years of sexual abuse. Murder has not personally visited me since then, but he ensured I would not be alone. He left friends in my company. Anger, fear, and pain have traveled with me as close companions and guides. They are comfortable companions. They are my familiars. I like them. This is trauma's pernicious trap. Trauma destroys memory. My memories have no order or confidence. These specific visits by murder left some record I can find, but anger, fear, and pain often loudly debate intimate details of memories I cannot track or confirm. They refuse to allow any discussion of vast stretches of my life. I retch at the inky, malevolent blanks as much as I do at the searing glare of memories that burn through my eyelids. I can rarely remember or differentiate friend from foe. Trauma bends the arc of the universe in perverse ways. I never believed my trauma to be real. Did I invite my assailant? I was not maimed or starved. I bear no physical disfigurement. Why did I not resist? It is all my pathetic narcissism. My trauma is de minimis. Anger, fear, and pain all assure me this is true, and I am safe only with them. They demand that under no circumstance will I question or reveal. They have made it clear that revelation will be swiftly punished with merciless ridicule that I am merely weak. I'm now beginning to understand that my travel companions might not be friends. This is PTSD and dissociation. This is profound shame. This is the natural and understandable neurobiology of trauma. Professionals who understand trauma far better than I do assure me my experience is common. As yet, I can take this only on faith. So a long walk to the punchline of being a man. This experience is common. Shocking estimates place childhood sexual assault as something that 1 in 3 women have experienced. In my work, I sadly can confirm this statistic. Best guesses are that 1 in 6 men share this humiliation, though the shame looks a little different. Being a man comes with enormous privilege. However, though we try to make it appear as if it comes with invincibility, it actually is more like an arrogant veneer of invincibility. You betray this thinness at your peril. As I rethink my relationship with my lifelong companions, I'm starting to understand that we are raised to believe that being a good man is to sit with anger and fear and pain and tolerate them, crooning, "You are damaged beyond cure. Just give up and be quiet." But valor is to reply, "You're right. Some of us are damaged beyond cure, but we are not beyond hope, beyond care. My trauma is not my failure. It is my privilege. I've been granted a gift of a chance to harness anger and fear for something good. Pain is here to help me atone for damage I cause when I stumble. As for many other men, anger, fear, and pain will always be in my company. My companions are cunning and terrible and fickle and cruel. Thugs are in my company, and at times I am thuggish too. Take care when judging a man by the company he keeps. He may deserve your rebuke, but he may also be struggling to abide his companions. Those companions are both his saviors and his tormentors.
I've been learning a lot over past few months and years about how manhood is a construct, an imposed role, and we're learning now to appreciate ways of being in the world that aren't clearly defined as manhood or womanhood. I'm working this in my own family. But for today, I'm going to refer to manhood as a set of social roles that have been traditionally associated with people whose male anatomy and gender align and are heterosexual. The shorthand for this is cisgendered heterosexual male, got all that in one place, and up until recently has been further shortened to men. Not coincidentally, the shorthand for all of humanity was men as well. It's that role, cisgendered male heterosexual, I'll add white, and standing in for all humanity that I'm describing. For some boys, that role chafes, and for all of us, it requires some painful adjustments. But for me, once those adjustments were made, I could not wait to assume it. I chafed at being a small, ignorant child because I knew what was expected of me as a man, and for me, that was to be responsible in my household, in my schools, in my surroundings, men were responsible, and so I would be. I would be self-reliant, responsible for my own well-being, but also one who ensured others' success. That didn't necessarily mean being in charge, though it often did, but it always meant that if some endeavor did not succeed, then there was something I could have done to make it better. Now, the psychological term for that is internal locus of control, and it's not a bad thing. You are the person you have the most control over. So if you have faith that your own actions can make a difference, you'll be more likely to act. That's how it's gone for me, and it's led to a lot of success in life for me, at least. So I refer to this model of manhood, that set of social roles, as the Atlas model, carrying the whole world on my shoulders. But being carried by Atlas isn't necessarily such a great favor. Many who are being carried, most in fact, would prefer to walk themselves and do their part to hold up the world, if only Atlas weren't quite so tall, holding it out of reach. And Atlas can get tired of carrying all this weight. Ayn Rand was all the rage with conservatives during the Tea Party era, and her hero, after holding the world out of reach for so long, decided to petulantly shrug. I'm not going to bother with any detailed refutation. That version of Atlas is a self-centered little boy. But what does Atlas do when he realizes that the role he prepared for and now happily fulfills is in fact harmful to those he carries? I'm still working on that. I'll tell you when I find out. For sure, it's not shrugging. But here's a possibility. How many of you have heard of Shirtless Dancing Guy? Anybody? That's a very famous YouTube video. And it's the subject of an often heard TED Talk. He's at an outdoor concert with no shirt. And he stands up and he starts dancing with abandon. A second guy joins him. Shirtless dancing guy takes his hands. They dance together and they're having a great time, so others get up and dance. And soon hundreds are dancing. You see people running in from off camera to get in on the fun. And the point of that TED talk was that it's the second guy and shirtless dancing guy's response to him that turned it into a movement. The first follower is key. But there's a better example than shirtless dancing guy, and that's one we don't really usually go in for here, which is Jesus. Now, back in the time around the birth of Christ, there were lots of Jesuses. There was a Jesus on every street corner. Don't believe me? Watch Life of Brian. There was a new urbanization, and that was entertainment, is to watch, to listen to people on the street corners, and there were a lot of shirtless dancing Jesuses. But what Jesus knew that the others didn't know is that he was nothing without followers. So he went out to get disciples, and it's the disciples that shaped Christianity as it is practiced today, much more than Jesus. Being a follower, being that influential follower, makes more difference than the guy who stands up in front and gets the credit. So this is something I'm still sorting out, because I know how to start things. I have that belief that I can start something and make it happen. But what I'm realizing is that it's just important, or maybe more important, to recognize when something that was not your idea and you are not the focus of it is in fact worth following and worth putting your hands on that globe to help hold it up and make something happen with it without you being the focus of it. And now we're going to have our closing hymn. This is not in your order of service, but many of you will know it. It's "The Times They Are A-Changin'." We're doing it a little differently, but if you know the words, please do feel free to sing along. Come on up, guys.